All right, so this is the session on motility of the small intestine, which is important to help with digestion. Too fast, diarrhea, malabsorption, too slow, you can get stasis, some local inflammation, bacterial overgrowth, and that can be problematic as well. So the contractions of the small bowel do at least three things. They help mix food with digestive enzymes. They help to circulate intestinal contents so that they contact the intestinal mucosa for absorption. Then there's net propulsion of contents towards the aboral or anal sort of end of the GI tract. The small intestine has two layers of smooth muscle, so an outer longitudinal layer and inner circular layer, and the cells of those are arranged as the name states. So the longitudinal ones, the long axis of the cells are arranged along the length of the bowel. The circular ones are arranged in circular patterns. And in general, the circular muscle is thicker, and both layers become less thick as you go distal in the GI tract. The innervation of the small intestine is such that the intrinsic nerves of the small bowel include the enteric nervous system. We'll talk more about that in a moment. And the extrinsic, which is the autonomic nervous system input. And so in general, the autonomic nervous system, the sympathetic system, is going to inhibit motility and secretion from the submucosal plexus, and it's going to inhibit the typical things we think of with digestion, although it can help contract sphincters and can cause some increased salivation. The parasympathetic is going to sort of increase all the things associated with digestion. So with respect to the intrinsic nerves, so the enteric nervous system and the interstitial cells of Cajal, there are two main plexes. And so the myenteric or Auerbach plexus is between the muscle layers, the circular and longitudinal muscle layers. And then the submucosal plexus is between the mucosal layer, which is composed of the epithelial layer, lamina propria, and the muscularis mucosae, as well as the submucosal layer. And so this is important because in general, a lot of the typical functions that are thought of as motility are a bit more significantly contributed to by the myenteric plexus, which makes sense as between the two muscle layers. And so there's an interesting concept that for propulsion, for peristalsis as we normally think about it, there's a bit of a not always so straightforward or logical thing that happens. And so say that there's a stimulus of stretch from a food bolus in the intestine. When the circular muscle layer contracts, it narrows the lumen. And so you can imagine if you just contracted in a sequential fashion down the length of the bowel, that might propel things to some extent. The longitudinal muscle layer, when it contracts, actually opens as it shortens the bowel. It actually opens the portion of the bowel that's just distal to where it's contracted. And so above a food bolus, you want to selectively contract the circular muscle, and you actually want to inhibit the longitudinal muscle because you don't want region above the food bolus to open. You want it to stay kind of relaxed, but not to contract and open. Distal to the food bolus, you actually want to inhibit the circular muscle layer when you're moving food along, or peristalsis, and you want to contract the longitudinal muscle layer because you do want to open the bowel distal to where the food bolus is. And so if you just remember that there are ascending and descending fibers that are sequentially moving in somewhat opposite fashions above and below food bolus. So if you think above the food bolus, contracting or stimulating contraction of the circular muscle and inhibiting the longitudinal muscle, and then just distal to the bolus, you're inhibiting circular muscle and stimulating contraction of longitudinal to open up the lumen. I think that's an important point to make, and that really plays into then this idea of different types of contractions of the small intestine, that there are segmentation contractions where you actually are contracting circular muscle as well, in sort of a to and fro fashion to help mix and locally circulate the contents of chyme and semi-digested foods. And then peristalsis, where the sequence of contraction I just mentioned, which is sometimes referred to as the law of the intestines. So there are videos that you can find online that if you stick a pellet of food in a piece of bowel that is removed from an animal and put in a tissue bath solution, that the bowel actually contracts and peristalsis that pellet through it, even though it is disconnected from the autonomic nervous system, which is, again, often referred to as the law of the intestines. In the next segment, just going to revisit a little bit about some of the patterns of contractions, including migrating motor complexes or MMCs. Talk about a couple of different reflexes that occur, and then we'll briefly touch on vomiting, although we may do a separate segment on sort of the pathophysiology of nausea and causes of vomiting, and then we'll be done. So a brief overview of some pathology in kind of categorizations of pathology with respect to small bowel motility. So if it's too quick, you can have difficulty absorbing and get diarrhea, malabsorption. If it's too slow, you can end up with stasis, SIBO or small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, pain and bloating, and constipation. And of course, SIBO can sometimes cause malabsorption as well. So it can be difficult to know which motility problem, whether it's too fast or too slow, is contributing to that specific symptom. In general, motility problems of the small intestine come with very non-specific symptoms. And so it can be pain, nausea, vomiting, bloating, altered bowel habits, either way, diarrhea or constipation, weight loss, times, and nutritional deficiencies. In general, we can categorize dysmotility into primary and secondary. So the primary forms are more rare. Some of the familial causes of chronic intestinal pseudoobstruction are CIPO, C-I-P-O. Secondary causes, which we see more often in adult gastroenterology, can include autonomic, so that could come with Parkinson's disease, multiple system atrophy, diabetes, after a stroke, autoimmune, autonomic neuropathy, certain medications and toxins. Some of the secondary causes that are enteric nervous system problems, as opposed to the prior, which was autonomic nervous system, include some overlap with diabetes, paraneoplastic syndromes, infections, post-infectious neuropathies, a high-fat diet, and then certain genetic causes. And then The smooth muscle cells can be the primary problem, meaning, you know, the nerves are intact and it's more of a myogenic or myopathic process. And this happens in hypothyroidism, amyloidosis, radiation enteritis, connective tissue disorders, scleroderma, and some other collagen vascular disorders and mitochondrial disorders. And then it's worth noting that I've gone back and forth as far as how much of a contributor this is to irritable bowel syndrome, but it seems to be a piece of the puzzle in irritable bowel syndrome, in that in irritable bowel syndrome constipation subtype, there are increased frequency and irregularity of luminal contractions. So it just discoordinated, contributing to overall slow motility. And there's a prolonged transit time in IBS-C for constipation. In IBS-D for diarrhea, there's often an exaggerated motor response to CCK and meals. And so, you know, these patients come in all the time and say, I eat and I have to immediately go to the bathroom, this exaggerated gastrocolic reflex. So in working towards a diagnosis of abnormal small intestinal motility, I'm going to go through the different modalities used to make the diagnosis in the next segment. And then the third kind of pathology correlates that we'll talk about is just the specific example of SIPO, or chronic intestinal pseudoobstruction. Just to revisit the four phases of the migrating motor complex, the phase one is basically ongoing electrical slow waves that are not associated with muscle contraction. So there's motor quiescence for about 45 to 60 minutes. Phase two, and this is occurring during the fasting or interdigestive period. Phase two is these slow waves become associated with some frequent but somewhat erratic phasic contractions, and then phase three is the activity front, where there's a front of large amplitude contractions lasting 5 to 15 minutes that march from the peristaltic pump portion of the stomach, so the distal body and antrum, towards the pyloric sphincter. When this happens, and this is neurally mediated, the pylorus and duodenum stay relaxed, so that phase three of the migrating motor complex can sweep food residue out of the stomach. When this is altered in a pathologic state, if the pylorus doesn't relax, you get a gastric outlet obstruction and gastric stasis. When it's too relaxed, this can sometimes trigger a duodenogastric reflex if too much empties into the duodenum and slow down contractions. And then phase four is really just the a gradual inhibition of contractile activity emerging with the next phase of the either digestive period with eating, or every 60 to 90 minutes these MMCs occur again while in the fasting period. So vagal stimulation immediately inhibits gastric motor and neurohormonal activity during both digestive and interdigestive periods. I wanted to comment that we spoke before about stretch, so mechanoreceptors, as well as certain neural factors that contribute to peristalsis, and how above a food bolus, the circular muscle layer with ascending fibers is stimulated to contract, while there's inhibition of the longitudinal layer so that it doesn't open the lumen just above the bolus that is trying to be pushed through. And then just distal to the bolus, the circular muscle layer, in order to not obstruct its movement along the bowel, by descending fibers is inhibited, and the longitudinal layer to open up the lumen is contracted. So that's happening at the level of the myenteric plexus. So the component of the enteric nervous system that is between the circular and longitudinal layers of muscle. There's also, as we briefly mentioned earlier, the Meissner's plexus or the submucosal plexus component of the enteric nervous system, which lies between the mucosa and the submucosal space, basically, so between the mucosa and the muscular layers. And so this has a slightly different function. It tends to do more with secretion of various sorts and blood flow to the GI tract. And so you can kind of think about three buckets of things that can happen related to the submucosal plexus. So it can, based on either neurohormonal controls or food in the stomach, so chemoreceptors stimulate certain glands to make more secretions of bicarbonate. It can also stimulate vasodilation of blood vessels, which brings more blood to that portion of the stomach or intestine. And lastly, there are, if you remember from the gastric peptides discussion, that the S cells that secrete secretin, again, and the strongest stimulus for that is a pH in the proximal duodenum of less than 4.5. It stimulates the S cells. Those are cells within the duodenum. And so the submucosal plexus, based on some of the chemoreceptors, are involved in the actual process of stimulating those S cells. The I cells, which make cholecystokinin, similarly in response to fatty acids more than, but also including amino acids and small peptides. And so you can kind of think about those three buckets of, you know, chemoreceptors contributing to secretion of different bicarbonate-rich juices, contributing to increasing blood flow to that part of the intestine by acting on the blood vessels in the local area, and also to stimulating some of these special function cells that are in the small bowel. All right, so moving along to some of the different diagnostic tests that can be done for small intestinal motility problems. And it's recommended these are only done when, there's a concern that there's severe chronic small intestinal dysmotility, and B, that it's going to potentially change treatment plan. So wireless motility capsule, just a note before we talk about that one in particular, also known as smart pill, should be clearly abnormal to call this motility. And this is important because healthy individuals can have up to 50% variation in their results if you repeat it. And so there's not a specific threshold that's perfect for diagnosing dysmotility. And so it should just be noted that it should be clearly abnormal. We'll talk about what that means. And then manometry for small intestine contractions, to really measure those, should only be done with severe, chronic, unexplained cases in which it will help the management. The reason this can be beneficial is wireless motility capsule, which is probably the most commonly used modality to look at dysmotility, is in the small bowel, can only measure pressure at one site. So it can't tell you a lot about actual coordinated propagation. So we're going to start with antroduodenal manometry, something that's done more often in selected centers and in pediatric neuro-GI. This can be used to rule out major motility disturbances in patients with otherwise equivocal findings. An abnormality can help you differentiate between neurogenic and myogenic. So is it the nerves or the muscles that are potentially the problem? And in some series, it's been reported to change the management in up to around 20 to 30% of cases. So that still means that 70% or more, it doesn't actually change management. You have to do this fasting as well as in the postprandial phase. And this is really looking to capture the migrating motor complexes, or MMCs. It's normal to have one every 24 hours. With successful transition from fasting to the postprandial phase, and should have an absence of MMCs for 2 hours or more after eating. So in autonomic disturbances that cause dysmotility, these often come with significant vagal dysfunction. And so in these, you may see abnormal phase three of MMCs and greater than three duodeno-jejunal MMCs over 3 hours during fasting, and absent antral MMC phase threes with the presence of some postprandial antral hypomotility and a rapid return of the MMC within 2 hours after a 400 or plus calorie meal is consumed. In other neurogenic causes of dysmotility, there can be antral hypomotility, which was mentioned before, abnormal propagation of these phase three of MMCs, hypercontractile duodeno-jejunal phase three MMCs, which there is a definition included in some of the literature of an amplitude of greater than 60 to 100 millimeters of mercury, and then failure to generate a fed response, which again should slow the MMCs. And then myogenic disorders and antral-duodenal manometry. Again, think the nerves are normal, but the muscles just can't respond. So these often demonstrate small MMCs with low amplitude of less than 20 millimeters of mercury. So think about scleroderma, amyloidosis, where there's connective tissue disorder, there's infiltration of the muscles, causing them to not be as effective. CIPO, chronic intestinal pseudoobstruction, 60% of those patients have abnormal manometry, but they most commonly have bursts of sustained phasic activity during fasting and abnormal MMC propagation. Abnormal manometry and recurrent episodes that mimic a mechanical obstruction of the bowel is the way that CIPO is actually defined. It's worth noting that manometry for actual obstruction has been demonstrated in some animal models, and this is seen as non-propagated clustered contractions of greater than 30 minutes and simultaneous prolonged greater than 8 seconds or summated contractions, even if it's equivocal on barium studies. So this is actually very specific for bowel obstruction, even if barium looks like it's, you know, passing through. It can be helpful, although rarely done. And then some other reasons to do small intestinal manometry. So it can help diagnose retrograde peristalsis, specifically in the post-Roux-en-Y population, where there's concern that maybe a wrong limb hooked up, or sometimes many years out, this can happen de novo from intrinsic pacemaker cells that are in the jejunum and ileum, so distal to where the key ones are in normal anatomy in the duodenum, for the small bowel. These can and do occur in a more sporadic fashion throughout the bowel, and sometimes those are thought to potentially play a role in some post-Roux-en-Y patients having retrograde peristalsis. It can exclude general dysmotility in patients with colonic inertia who are headed for subtotal colectomy, because the last thing you want to do is take out a colon and find out actually there's a generalized dysmotility involving the small bowel and or stomach, as some of those patients don't actually improve and still have issues. And then rumination can be detected on antroduodenal manometry, but now high-resolution esophageal manometry is preferred. So that's antroduodenal manometry. A lot about it, something you probably won't encounter a lot outside of pediatrics and some select centers. Briefly, just to mention, upper GI series, plus or minus a small bowel follow-through, can help detect mechanical obstruction, can demonstrate local and or global dilation, and small bowel diverticulae. It's less helpful with motility. Whole gut scintigraphy has traditionally been the one of the gold standards, and it's really the oral cecal transit time, so the time for radiolabeled indium or technetium to hit the cecum. And there are different definitions used, the time it takes 10 or 50% of contrast load to hit the cecum, correcting, of course, for gastric emptying time, because oral cecal transit time encompasses the stomach as well as the small bowel. And another definition used sometimes is just the amount in the cecum after 6 hours, with normal being 10 to 70%. So if you're less than 10%, not enough is getting there. If you're over 70%, maybe somewhat fast small bowel motility. Wireless motility capsule, the smart pill, tells you a number of things. It can tell you pH, can tell you pressure, but as we mentioned before, it can only tell you the pressure at specific single location at a time, and not so much about propagation. Can tell you the temperature of the whole GI tract. And so the small bowel transit is really the time it takes from the moment it moves from the stomach to the small bowel, and then from the small bowel to the cecum. And this is detected actually using primarily pH changes. So when you go from the stomach, which has a low pH, and you see this abrupt upswing in pH, so it is an abrupt increase in the pH to a more alkaline environment, that is consistent with movement from the stomach to the duodenum. So that starts the small bowel transit time. And then the cecum is typically a lower pH, a bit more acidic compared to the ileum. And there's also a change in pressure. It's a lower pressure, more compliant. And so you see kind of a drop in pressure and a drop in pH. And that's when you know you're out of the small bowel. And normal on a wireless motility capsule is 2.5 to 6 hours. So looking for something, again, as I mentioned at the beginning, fairly dramatically abnormal and things kind of right on the cusp, you should use some caution in calling with a single study just because of the variation within normal subjects. MRI, specifically enterography and CT enterography, can be helpful, probably more so MRE or enterography. Scintigraphy, as I mentioned, is still the reference standard for small bowel transit time. It's usually done as part of a whole gut transit study. It visualizes the passage of a radioactive marker through the small bowel, but this is not standardized. Wireless motility capsule can, again, just kind of recapping things, be used to tell you pH landmarks, so the pylorus to the duodenum, where you see a significant increase in the pH, so more acidic to more alkaline, means you're in the small bowel. And then from the ileum to the cecum, you see a drop in pH, so more acidic in the cecum with a slight decrease in pressure as well. And there's moderate correlation of healthy subjects with scintigraphy between the wireless motility capsule and scintigraphy. It is, again, important to note some of the limitations of wireless motility capsule in that greater than 10% of healthy controls, they were unable to actually tell where the ileocecal junction was based on wireless motility capsule, meaning that change is less dramatic than the stomach to duodenum change, both in pH and pressure, and over 10% of healthy controls that was not able to be detected very confidently. And it's more validated really for gastric emptying and whole gut or colonic transit than it is for small bowel, though that's being used for that as well. Last 2 points to mention. So one, for contractile patterns in the small intestine, small intestinal motility is the reference test. It's catheter-based. There are multiple pressure sensors, although it typically is this is just covering the proximal small bowel, so the duodenum and proximal jejunum. It's done fasting and then 2 hours after eating a test meal, or it can be done for 24 hour plus in a different format. And then lastly, there is some utility of breath testing for small bowel transit, specifically lactulose hydrogen breath test, which is cheap and non-invasive, but it's a lot less precise. It is semi-quantitative. It tells you oral cecal transit time with increased hydrogen exhalation associated with cecal delivery and subsequent bacterial metabolism of non-absorbable saccharide lactulose. And lactulose, so part of the problem with this test is that lactulose can, as it is often used as a laxative, it can accelerate oral cecal transit time due to its impact on osmotic fluxes, and it can delay gastric emptying. And so those are both problematic in interpretation. SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth patients, have falsely short transit times, which is a problem as this can be seen with abnormal motility conditions, or can just be from the SIBO. And it doesn't specifically tell you about small bowel transit time. It's a summation of the gastric and small intestinal motility. And so again, alterations in gastric emptying can alter the oral cecal transit time measured by the lactulose hydrogen breath test either way. So chronic intestinal pseudoobstruction is this CIPO, C-I-P-O, is severe abnormal propulsive of gut motility that mimics mechanical obstruction. It causes 15% of intestinal failure in peds and 20% in adults. While there are acute forms of intestinal pseudoobstruction, the chronic form can be idiopathic or secondary. Idiopathic forms can be sporadic. There are some familial autosomal dominant and recessive forms of the disease that are very rare. Secondary SIPO, the most common causes are hypothyroidism, hypoparathyroidism, or celiac disease. And there are derangements seen in nerves, muscle cells, as well as the mesenchymal or interstitial cells of Cajal. Clinically, these patients have recurrent episodic abdominal pain, distension, inability to defecate, and plus or minus vomiting. When it upper disease is more significant, they tend to have weight loss, nausea, vomiting. When it's lower down, obstruction is the most involved area, they tend to have abdominal pain, distension, and constipation. Secondary small intestinal bacterial overgrowth or superimposed SIBO can contribute to diarrhea and steatorrhea. And this is often a progressive disease, disabling, and about a quarter end up needing TPN, with many ending up receiving narcotics, which of course can worsen things. To diagnose it, it's radiology, so distended loops, air fluid levels like an obstruction. Sometimes endoscopy is done to rule out celiac disease as a cause of secondary SIPO. Manometry is sometimes done to rule out Hirschsprung's disease. Ideally, do the biopsies that are full thickness from dilated and non-dilated parts of the bowel, but obviously this is almost never done. And then the one-third of the patients who ended up needing TPN in one series had conditions such as scleroderma. When they went in and did jejunal biopsies, but unfortunately this rarely changed their treatment, which is another reason beside the morbidity and mortality of trying to do full thickness biopsies, that this is just not done treatment-wise acutely. Gonna decompress them, sometimes from both ends, IV fluids, try to remove any medicines that can be causative, treat infections, treat things that can exacerbate this, hypokalemia, for instance. Nutritional support, often in the way of small, frequent, liquid, or homogenized meals. Pharmacologically, end up treating a lot of, mostly the symptoms of nausea. Can use antidiarrheals, laxatives, antispasmodics, analgesics, but ideally not heavy on the opiates. Prokinetics don't have a consistent role, but are sometimes used outside the U.S. Cisapride is used, but there are case series using erythromycin, octreotide, sometimes antibiotics such as rifaxin or neomycin to treat SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And then surgery has a limited role, just because most patients with SIPO have some degree of whole GI tract dysmotility. There's not a specific segment that can often be cut out to improve symptoms. So a difficult patient population to manage. So that ends the pathology correlates, and look forward to covering large intestine motility in the next session. So the final brief segment, just discussing a couple of resources to consider. One is a 2008 paper called The Advances in the Diagnosis and Classification of Gastric and Intestinal Motility Disorders, which was published, the lead author, Judda Keller, in Nature Reviews in Gastroenterology and Hepatology in 2018. And this goes through a lot of the diagnostic testing that was discussed in this international working group for disorders of gastrointestinal motility and function. And so that's a great paper to kind of talk about the different options. The textbook, the Lang textbook for gastrointestinal physiology, and then the chapter on intestinal motility from the Johnson GI physiology textbook also is a nice resource for this.